instruments. Conditions apply. Call 262-577-5488. Classic Violins, where quality meets tradition.
This is WGTD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show is hosted by Felicia King of Quality Plus Consulting and airs the first and third Saturdays of every month.
Good morning. You're listening to Breakfast Bites, and I'm Felicia King. Today's show is going to be about a browser add-in called NewsGuard, and then we will talk about some security things that have happened to people recently that you should know about so that you can learn from it and not be a victim. It's actually not that difficult to avoid being a victim of cybersecurity fraud, etc. You just have to be vigilant. So let's learn from the hard-earned lessons of others. All right, so first off, let's talk about NewsGuard. Now, NewsGuard is a it's an add-on to Edge browser, and it's being implemented right now in Edge browsers, and certainly on the Android and the iOS versions of the Edge browser, which you probably don't even use that browser on those phone platforms. But certainly if you have a Windows 10 computer, then you have the Edge browser, and you very well may use it. In fact, pretty much everybody that uses Office 365 is using the Edge browser because of all of the single sign-on integrated experience components with browser. And really in this today and age, you have to have multiple browsers on your computer because it is impossible to have a situation where you're a computer knowledge worker. And I say knowledge worker being the classification of somebody who is using a computer to do their job full-time, you know, so not somebody who's occasionally using a computer, but somebody who's using a computer all the time in order to do their job. So when you're in that category, you have to interact with a lot of different websites, and it is just not possible to find one browser that works with all websites in all circumstances. So as a result, it's standard operating procedure to run multiple browsers on a computer. And that's really not a big deal. They certainly do coexist quite well. You just have to have all of those software packages kept up to date so that they are secure, so that you can browse the internet securely. Speaking of which, there are security updates for Adobe Reader, Adobe Flash, Java, and certainly Edge browser. So as always, all of your software needs to be updated. So if you don't have an automated process in place to not only do that, but validate that it's done, then check your software packages yourself and make sure that they're all up to date. Well, with regards to this NewsGuard particular application, this is really just a travesty of horror show as far as I'm concerned, because what it is intending to do, according to the makers of it, is it's intending to provide a rating that they have come up with on their own with their own biased mechanisms in order to flag a website as fake news or not fake news. And if you just make an intellectually honest assessment of what they're using in terms of delineations between whether or not a site is fake news or not fake news, it's total malarkey beyond all belief. So my opinion on this is that NewsGuard is fake news itself. It is just another propaganda tool. And in the grand scheme of things, aren't we all supposed to be critical thinking, intelligent adults anyways, able to look at opposing viewpoints and come to our own critical thinking objective on our own? You know, since when is it that we need to be told by some third party what is fake news? Shouldn't we be able to figure this out on our own? And do you really want to trust somebody else's, you know, biased opinion on such things? So if you see this NewsGuard thing come up, my suggestion to you is that you discount it completely, because there's pretty much all the experts that are out there that exist in the IT community, certainly in the IT security community, and even longtime Microsoft advocates are not buying into the propagandized baloney that is the NewsGuard plugin. I mean, it's even proven that Microsoft themselves publish fake news. So can you honestly make a statement that a website should get a, oh, they never publish fake news, when even Microsoft themselves publishes fake news? Google publishes fake news. I mean, can't you make the argument that everybody publishes fake news at some point in time, which is why we as intelligent, critical thinking, objective adults are supposed to be able to make that determination on our own? We don't need a tool to tell us that. All right, let's move on to security lessons that we can learn from the challenges that other people have been faced with. Well, the last couple of months have been rather interesting. It's been quite a bit of a wild ride, because there are patterns and trends that exist in the security space for information technology. And as a result of these patterns, then the business people, users of computer systems, etc., have to respond to these changing trends and patterns. Now, one of the biggest tectonic shifts that happened more recently was around the January 2016 timeframe. Not only at that time were a lot of security algorithms that were old, they became deprecated at that time, which that was a big enough shift in itself, which caused a lot of application changes. You know, you look at the fact that now Google Chrome is marking as a warning anything that is not running over HTTPS. This was a big tectonic shift, which in that case, I fully supported that one. And certainly the deprecating of old insecure security algorithms that no longer were secure enough, that needed to be done as well, which is why GCM is the only thing that the DoD uses anymore. And what that means to you is that if you're not using GCM, well, you should be. So the biggest tectonic shift now is really kind of a play on of a component of that started in January 2016. Now, prior to January 2016, I would say that in the residential market, you could get by without having a network security appliance. But that really dramatically changed right around January 2016 to the point where people couldn't even browse the internet anymore without getting their computers destroyed by garbage. So what I saw was a huge uptick in the adoption of security appliances in the residential market. Certainly there still are plenty of, in fact, the vast majority of residential users do not have security appliances. However, in those cases, I would argue that their computers are most likely compromised and they don't even know it. There are crypto miner applications that install in a fileless, persistent manner on computers, and they steal your compute capacity in order to make money for hackers through cryptocurrency crypto mining. So that's just one of the elements. Another element is to passively do reconnaissance and to steal passwords, contact lists, content, information to get onto your banking website, these sorts of things. I think that the vast majority of computers out there nowadays that are not sitting behind a network security appliance with multiple other layers of security protection, I think they're all just hacked. And what I've really seen is this tectonic shift is this uptick in persistent, fileless, reconnaissance mode type of compromise tools. So the hackers are not so much interested in just destroying and ransomwaring your computer. I'm not saying that ransomware doesn't exist anymore. It certainly does. But they're less interested in that than they are in approaches that give themselves surreptitious persistence in your environment, whether it be your residential home computer or in a business. And that's also not terribly new, but the ability of the persistence and the surreptitiousness to exist has increased. You know, it's really become very sophisticated to the point where again, unless you have very extensive security measures, then their ability to infiltrate and stay there and have persistence and to do so in the background without you even knowing about it, that has increased dramatically. That not only has that approach, but their ability to execute that approach has increased substantially. And so what I started seeing in January was that everyone who did not have multi-factor authentication already enabled on their master email accounts, as well as in combination that they were not browsing the internet protected by a perimeter security appliance or a network security appliance. So if they didn't have the network layer protection, and then coupled that with they did not have multi-factor authentication enabled on their primary email account, then in those cases, their primary email accounts were absolutely 100% compromised. So in one case I saw, and this is all firsthand that I'm seeing this, so everything that I convey to you is things that I've confirmed with my own eyes. In one case, the person visited a website, the website executed a malicious script, the malicious script connected into the Outlook client on the computer, and therefore it used the credentials associated with that open Outlook instance. It created mail forwarding rules, it harvested the entire contacts list, it exfiltrated a bunch of data through the email mechanism itself, and then it sniffed the cached password, and then remote authentication was made into that mailbox where they used that mailbox to send out in excess of 500 emails to all of these people that were in the contacts list of this person. And those emails included a ransomware-laden link to a Dropbox location. So now imagine the adverse impact if that was you and your account was being used to hack in excess of 500 people that you knew. Well, let's just say, at the very least, that's bad for public relations. And you may say, well, gee, why did it stop at 500? Well, because there are security measures in place where when that level of spamming is going on, the account will just lock out. So yay for that. But it would not have happened, number one, had the computer user been browsing the internet protected by a network security appliance. But number two, the extensiveness of the breach would not have been allowed to occur had the account had multi-factor authentication enabled. Okay, well, there's another element to this too, that multi-factor authentication is not a panacea. It does not include things like GOIP blocking, which is an extremely effective technique. So the GOIP blocking, the only way you're going to get something like that in conditional access rules is to have another layer of sophisticated security measures. And in that case, you can write these conditional access rules where you're using another level of security that says, oh, this is a trusted device, or it's a device that you've already gone through an enrollment process on, and so therefore it's more trusted than a device that has not been logged onto before. So in the case that the bad guys were to compromise credentials, they would be denied. So number one, they could be denied outright just simply because you might have a conditional access rule that says that if the authentication is not coming from either US IP addresses or a set of predefined static WAN IP addresses, then it's just going to be outright blocked. When you have these additional security measures, you can do things like enable account lockout, which is very powerful as well, because that in itself defeats brute force password attacks. And then when you have these additional security measures, you can now get reporting as well. So these reports will tell you whether or not the security measures that you're using are effective. It's going to tell you if unauthorized parties have been able to log into the account, or if unauthorized login attempts were blocked, where they were originated from, and what type of client was being used, etc. You get quite a lot of good information on there. So either way, you need to have this validation process. So the unfortunate piece is, unless you have this extra level of protection, which, by the way, costs like $150 a year extra, that's it. So it's really extremely cost-effective to have that. So if you have this other extra layer of protection, you can get full validation. So not only can you craft more granular rule sets around who can access your critical account, which is the gateway to your content, whether it be your cloud-hosted OneDrive, email system, SharePoint data, or anything else, frankly. Now, I'm not aware of G Suite having this level of capability. Certainly Office 365 does have that capability. Not all email systems have that capability. So in the case of Office 365, the additional security product that I'm talking about is a solution called Enterprise Mobility Suite with the E5 level of licensing, which gives you things like Azure Active Directory Plan 2 and Intune and Cloud App Security. There's a variety of things there, but fundamentally, it all actually has to be configured. So simply just going and buying it isn't going to do you that much good. You have to actually configure things. You don't just magically get conditional access policies out of the box. These things have to be configured. So if you do have an interest in such things, in preventing your systems from being breached, then I can't strongly enough recommend that you find a qualified IT consultant who has those Office 365 certifications to be able to implement that for you. And they probably, and really, they should be using it in their own environment as well, because then we're talking about writing policies for devices as well, like your Windows computers and your phones. All right, let's talk about the second security incident that happened. So it originated really in the same way as the first one did, which was browsing the internet, not protected by a security appliance, and then the script executes. It grabs the credentials that are cached. It uses the cached open existing Outlook connection to be able to do naughty things, such as harvest the contacts list, harvest all the email, I might add, and data exfiltrate through a forwarding rule. So this one happened to be even more interesting than the first one, simply because the hackers changed their tactics because they perceived this individual to be a whale. Now, let me explain what I mean by that terminology. Hackers do a technique called phishing, which is phishing, right? Phishing. So what they're doing is, of course, it's like the reason that the IT community came up with this terminology was because, you know, you go out and you fish for fish, right? You try to hook something. Well, phishing can catch a lot of wide variety sized fishes. Well, then there's a term called whaling. And whaling is when they are trying to compromise a user who they think is a high-value target. That's why they call it whaling. So they had identified this person as someone who they could glean intel from for the purposes of being able to commit massive wire fraud. And this happened to be a person in the real estate industry, which, as a result of things, data getting exfiltrated, resulted in data about deals, you know, closings, real estate purchases. And of course, in real estate purchases, there's going to be some substantial money involved. So the outcome was that this data was exfiltrated, and initial level of remediation, response, lockdown had been successfully handled. But because the data was already exfiltrated, then the knowledge about these closings and the parties involved in these closings was already obtained by the hackers at that point. And the hackers, what they ended up doing, this is where it gets really interesting, they went out and whaled further. They engaged in more phishing on a further basis. They then fished one of the buyers, they fished the title company, and they managed to convince the title company and the buyer that there were other email addresses that they should be emailing each other from, and as a result, the hackers were able to craft wire transfer emails that looked very, very legitimate, but contained false wire transfer data in there. And I say false, meaning that it was not actually the wire transfer data for the title company. It was instead wire transfer data for the hacker's bank account. So in one of the cases, there was a very substantial wire transfer fraud that was perpetrated successfully. And now, in terms of protecting yourself against something like this, I would hope that everyone listening to this show would understand that you don't just wire transfer data, you know, your money. You don't just do that. What you do is you have to call the bank. So first off, independently look up the phone number for the bank. Call the bank. Say, hey, I'm going to wire transfer you some money. I need to verify that this routing number is actually your bank and that this account number that I've been given is actually going to result in the funds being delivered to the intended recipients. Now, there are many banks that do what's called an FBO account, which is for the beneficial ownership of. So they may have Western Union is a great example of this. The Western Union, obviously they're not a bank, right? But they have accounts with Bank of New York Mellon, where Western Union is really handling an FBO business. They do a very good job of it, I might add. And so it's really a matter of calling the appropriate party, talking to them like a real human being, using your independently verified information in order to verify that the account information that you've been provided is accurate. Because unlike an ACH, or unlike a personal check, or unlike a variety of other funds transfer mechanisms, a wire does not have the same ability to claw back funds. You don't really have consumer protection over wire transfers. Once you send the money, it is gone. So you need to take your time and be extra diligent about verifying that wire transfer money or that wire transfer information. So another interesting aspect of this whole incident that happened was there were additional wire transfer fraud attempts perpetrated against other people involved in other real estate transactions. Now, those all ended up being unsuccessful just simply because, you know, the human due diligence turned up, meaning that the title company apparently started to tell people, hey, you should really call. Like, don't just believe you've received an email from us and think that that information that you've received is perfect and correct. Now, in finality, there's another really fascinating aspect to this whole incident, which is that you have to ask how it is that these emails were even getting through, considering the sophisticated nature of email filtering capabilities that exist in today's modern email systems. Well, I traced it down to a couple pathways. Pathway number one was, we go back to the element of GOIP blocking. So if you're running an email system, or if you're simply an end user business decision maker where you've hired somebody else to manage your email system, you need to ask the question about international spam. There's an element of international spam protection that is very similar to GOIP blocking. So look, if you don't do business with people from Brazil, then why should you be receiving email from Brazil servers, Brazil mail servers, or that have Brazilian, you know, Portuguese language in them? This turns out to be a very effective mechanism, and I can't see how you would have any adverse impact to block everything except United States and, you know, maybe Germany and the UK and Australia, New Zealand, something like that. You know, you'd have to actually think it through what your allowed countries as origination of emails are going to be. But for the most part, pretty much everybody in the SMB space can come up with that list and say, you know, really, we don't do business with Zimbabwe. We don't need to be receiving any emails from any email servers in Zimbabwe. So that's a very effective mechanism for stopping some of that international spam. Now, the other piece of how these emails were actually getting through to the recipient is they were very well-crafted spoofing emails. Now, by default, most email systems do not have anti-spoofing protection built in. And the reason for this is because in order to set up anti-spoofing protection, you have to be pretty darn smart in terms of crafting rules for things that are going to be allowed, such as on-premise relay servers or other legitimate relay sources. And you also have to know exactly what you're doing about crafting things like DKIM and SPF DNS records, which is way above the pay grade of most people. Now, it shouldn't be above the pay grade of anyone who's actually a professional IT consultant who's certified in something like Office 365, okay? Those types of people should be able to handle it, no problem. But this really comes down to an element of, are you as a customer asking to verify these things are in place? Here's a good way of finding out. If you go to a website called whatsmydns.net, so that is the word what with an S, my, mydns.net, so whatsmydns.net. If you take your domain name and you put it in there, and you select to see a text record, a TXT format text record, you should see an SPF record for your email domain. If you do not, well, then I suggest you find some competent IT help to help you. Now, I had recently received one of these spoofing messages in my quarantine, because that's where I have the spoofing emails go, is into the quarantine so that I can investigate the message headers. And in this case, it had bypassed the international spam filtering, but the spoofing detection had picked it up and quarantined it and then notified me about it. And I traced it back to a MedTechLab website, MedTechLab company, which was supposed to be a HIPAA-compliant company. According to the email message header, it showed that the message had actually come from their mail server and from the mailbox of the IT person. Now, I looked up the SPF record for MedTechLab, and I found that they didn't have one. And when I looked at the message header information, it showed that they were still running Exchange 2000. So at this point, my head is exploding. I literally called them, and I pressed the button on their voicemail system for, you know, connect me with tech support, and it went into this person's mailbox. Turns out the person's voicemail box, whose it was actually the IT person whose mailbox had been compromised and who the spoofed emails were actually coming from. So I called, I basically left a voicemail and said, hey, your mailbox is compromised. You know, so if you as an end user or as a business owner want to check if you have a properly formatted SPF, there should be a dash at the end of that SPF record in order to denote a hard fail. And this is one of the mechanisms whereby you have anti-spoofing protection. But beyond that, there has to be specially crafted rules in your email system for anti-spoofing protection. And they are complex to create, but sufficiently talented IT people should be able to do this for you. The anti-spoofing protection is absolutely essential now. I have just seen a